Commerce will now come to order. We're running a bit late because we just got out of a floor session. Today is Wednesday, April 15th. We do have a quorum. Representing Badoo, representing Hughes, representing Keto, and myself, Chair Olson. We expect, representing Tilton. We do have a quorum, and please turn off your cell phones. We have a full calendar on the slate today. We have one bill that we previously heard that we're anticipating will move rather quickly. We have two House bills that need to be read across so they can be worked on during the interim, and then we have two Senate bills, so we'll see how far we get down. But the first one up is House Bill 12, and who do we have? Ginger, I guess.
Yes. Oh, I'm sorry.
We heard this bill on Monday. We adopted version H. The CS is the working document and took public testimony. A fiscal note was received while the meeting was in progress and has been before the committee for a couple of days. And we've been joined by Representative Josephson as well. Welcome. Ginger, can you give us a real brief recap?
Yes.
50,000 foot.
Yes, thank you. My name is Ginger Blaisdell, and I'm staff to Representative Hughes. The 50,000 foot version of this bill is that by changing some of the state statutes regarding mortgage licensing, it creates an equal playing field for mortgage brokers, mortgage loan originators, and a similar oversight from banks or registered depository institutions.
And I might add that this bill was originally opposed by the State Bankers Association and several other people, but the changes in the CS pretty well neutralized the opposition to the bill. And we do have public testimony still open. Is there anybody in the room that would care to testify that hasn't seen them? Is there anybody online? Seeing them, public testimony is closed. Any questions for Ginger? Seeing them, what are the wishes of the committee?
Mr. Chairman, I move CSHB 12 version, put on your glasses, version 29 LS0089/H from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Seeing none, the bill will move out of committee. We'll take a brief at ease. Back on the record. Next bill on the calendar, I believe, is House Bill 159. Does that sound right, Wes?
Yes.
That is it.
Yeah.
Please state your name and affiliation for the record. And are both of you going to be presenting?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will start, and I will like to let my staff, Ken, fill in some blanks for me. I'm Representative Wes Keller. I represent District 10, and I thank you to the committee for taking time out of this day. You didn't have anything else today to do anyway, I know, so I appreciate very much you taking the time. And then, Ken, you want to identify yourself for the record?
My name is Ken Truitt. I'm staff to represent Keller. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee.
And so if it's your wish, what I'd like to do is just give a brief overview of what the bill is about, and then you could leave it open for questions. And
yeah, we'll be holding it over, but at least this way you'll be able to have it on the record and be able to have hearings during the summer.
Thank you. I'm, my medical background is a little weak. I was a builder and a pilot and teacher and that kind of thing. But I was put on the Alaska Health Commission here in 2007 and have been following that process very closely. I have become convinced that the health care reform that is needed is we need to have the market working. You know, we need to have pressures and interest of people buying and selling at some level to change it so that we know what it is that we're buying and that we can have some choices. This bill simply amends the state insurance code by exempting direct primary care associations from the definitions of insurance. It does not propose impose any new regulations, and it does not incur any additional expense as it stands now. The idea is, just in very general, quick terms, is it allows primary care physicians to contract directly with a patient for primary care services. It's a contractual agreement between a primary care doc, licensed normally, with a patient. It takes up the necessity and a pure sense for any third-party payer. There just isn't there. So people subscribe to the primary care service. And it's not a new concept. I'm pretty sure you probably have all heard about it. There's just very intriguing stories online about people that have their doc just one cell phone call away, one text away, and they're involved at a different level than what we're used to. It doesn't, the contracts that would be set up in this situation would be handled by existing law. There's nothing new added, and just very briefly, the positive effects of this, if when it passes, and I'll put it positive, when it passes, is the quality of care and the access of care that patients will have with their primary care provider. And overall, there will be reduced health care costs. The administrative cost goes way down, because if you have this contract between a doctor and a patient, you just get rid of all the layers, middle layers. And other states that have done this, the numbers are just stunning. You know, the number of docs per, or patients per doc, I should say, is really high. And, you know, this, a doc can make a pretty good living. I'm not going to name a number, but it, with far fewer patients. And the bottom line is the doctor has more time to spend with the patient, and that is the answer. Right now, I've talked to several doctors and heard of doctors. You probably have to that complain a little bit about having, you know, 15 minutes a patient kind of thing, and if they miss one or one takes longer, then their whole day is a deck of cards that goes down. The stresses on the docs are higher than other states where they've done this. You know, it just takes that away, and they're enjoying it more. So I'm going to stop there, and if you have more specific bills or you want my staff to go more specifically over the language of the bill, I'm open to that.
Anything you'd like to add?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Not unless there are specific questions from you or members of the committee. Thank you.
Any questions?
Yes. Thank you for bringing this forward. I like the out-of-the-box thinking, and I know there are other states doing things like this. There's one thing, excuse me, I'm curious about, because it prohibits the provider from billing insurance or an insurer, but the patient can. How would that work?
Thank you, Representative, and Mr. Chairman, through the chair. The concept behind that is that...
Oh, could you say your name and affiliation?
Ken Truitt, thank you for the record. Sorry, Mr. Chairman, staff to Representative Keller. The concept behind that is that this bill, the concept wouldn't change any existing relationship. So if a patient still has insurance that provides primary care as a part of that insurance package, the patient then can seek reimbursement for the costs of that care, which would include membership into this primary care network.
Follow up.
And I guess, are there insurers who will pay for like a monthly type service? Is that happening? Are there insurance companies that provide that, and is that happening in other states? I've not heard of it.
Mr. Chairman, and through the chair, Representative Hughes, I don't know the answer to that question. I know that this particular legislation came from the bill that was passed in Michigan. And I've looked at the different states that have primary care legislation, and Utah has this exact language in their statute as well.
And I might add, we have several bills that are medically related that we can most likely also hold a hearing up in Anchorage, I would suspect, since most of our members are from that part of the state. But Representative Ledoux.
Did I understand right that this bill prohibits the doctors from billing the insurance companies?
Mr. Chairman, and through the chair, Representative Ledoux, yes, that's correct. The concept behind this is to really relieve the physicians from the burden of dealing with third-party payers. And just for way of example, we printed off the different billing manuals. This is the billing manual for Blue Cross. It's over 200 pages, and it's double-sided.
Probably small font.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. This is the provider manual for Medicare. Again, double-sided. This is the provider manual for our state Medicaid plan. So for the provider, the benefit for the provider is being relieved from having to work all of these and know all of these manuals to get paid. They're paid through their contract with their patient, and then they're removed from dealing with the third-party payers.
Follow up, but first, could we get a copy of those for Conrad? We'll scan them and put them on our site. Representative Ledoux.
I guess I don't get it. I mean, a doctor right now, in fact, I've had doctors who, in order to hold down their fees, they say they're not going to bill the insurance company, and they put the onus on the patient to bill the insurance company. Why would you have to have written in statute a statutory provision prohibiting a doctor from billing an insurance company? I mean, I guess that seems to me like it's really interfering with, it doesn't sound like very limited government to me.
Representative Ledoux, through the chair, a valid question. The bill isn't moving. We will consider it and get back with you with the logic and that has happened in other states on that.
Thank you.
Representative Kito, followed by Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Keller, I do have a question. If we do look at something like this, I guess I'm wondering what provider networks are existing in Alaska that would utilize a program like this. Is there a company, a doctor's office, or something that's looking for this as an alternative or an option, or is this something that you're wanting to put out there for somebody else to try and pick up?
Representative Kito, through the chair, I know of nobody in particular. I have doctor friends that, you know, that are interested in, you know, or positively inclined. I got to know them through, some of them through the Alaska Health Commission, but of course, now that can't be done. You know, they cannot set up that type of network, and it was talked about in the context of possible health care reforms.
Follow.
Thank you. Just a new question, simple one, I think. So if we're looking at this situation where we've got a contract, is that a monthly fee thing, or is that going to be like a fee for service? So I guess if I'm paying a monthly fee, I go in and I get a procedure or a process. If you're saying that, then I as a patient go out to bill, how do I find that billing code, and how do I identify what that amount for that procedure is so I can then bill it?
That's questions that have to be dealt with, but this bill does not allow, there does not speak to that. Where it does, it allows a contract to be set up between a doctor and a patient. So I've seen some reference, you know, I mean, just thinking out of the box again, some of these contracts are subscriptions for the, I would assume, would be different, you know, for each doc and each patient, maybe. But anyway, I've seen somewhere the subscription or the agreement actually allowed the doctor to provide care for any family or friends that come visiting. You know, so in Alaska, my folks come up here to visit, right? And under this kind of a subscription, I might have a clause in there where I'm paying X amount of dollars a month for the subscription, and if my parents or sibling or something got sick, you know, I could bring it, just call my doc and have that primary care available to them. The reason I bring that up, Representative Kito, is that the sky's the limit, really. I mean, because it does not propose the subscription size or what should be included, other than the fact that it is primary care. And in other states, the rates range, I saw here, somewhere between $80 and $200 a month for these subscriptions that are happening in other states.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Keller, I'm just curious, and I can sort of do my own research, but what would the client or patient be giving up in terms of regulatory protections? What are the core things that that might be given up in under the statute in order to accrue some other benefit. I understand there are benefits, but and if we've got Ms. Wing-Hire here, I'm just wondering what we surrender in return for those benefits.
Representative Josephson, through the chair, I don't know that there's any increased risk to the patient for making this kind of a contract with a primary care doctor, but I don't know the... if you can find something, let us know. I haven't run across anything. I haven't read anything on that.
And again, for the people in the room and the people that might be online, the intent was to have three of the bills that came up at the end of the year be read across so we could begin the work on them during the interim. So when we get back down here in January, they'll be some of the first ones that will be in a position to move. Representative Keller?
Yeah, thank you, Chair Olson. I just, you probably will do this anyway, but I just wanted to put on the record that the Division of Insurance has talked to me. They are willing to talk to you today, and they are expressing an eagerness to work with us on this bill. So,
Representative Ledoux.
I was just going to clarify something. This BIM doesn't exactly prohibit doctors from billing insurance companies. It's part of the contract that somebody might make with the...
Yeah, thanks.
And then, can I just make an additional?
Sure.
I've actually read about these. They're concierge services where people pay $200-$300 a month just so that they will have the benefit of a private physician. And a lot of physicians, I think it is in California, where they become very popular lately, have decided that that's the way to go in order to avoid dealing with Medicaid, Medicare, and the various private insurers and the billing stuff that's involved there. So, I mean, but again, the question that Representative Hughes or Tilton, I can't remember which one, made, it might be difficult if the doctor doesn't provide you with billing information to actually bill your insurance company. But sometimes people might be interested in just doing this so that they can get a doctor's appointment.
One last comment?
If I could. Yeah, I'm glad to thank you for bringing that up. I just, if you're interested, a quick search in Google on concierge medicine. For years, really fun stories. I mean, you know, just a whole group of them. And one of them that jumps to mind is this gal expressing her gratitude and appreciation. Her father-in-law died, and she grabbed the phone. The first person she called was her primary care doc. Well, he was already there. And the reason he was there is that they had been making house calls, you know, regularly, and he knew what was going on, and he was keeping track. And then, so, you know, he was there taking care of this lady's mom. And, you know, I just, fun stories like that. I mean, it is, it kind of reminds me of what we idealized, at least what I idealized when I was a kid, of what healthcare was all about.
Or how it used to be.
Yeah.
Marcus Wimby, M.D.
Yeah.
Thanks again, Representative Thank Keller. Brief the news. Is that yours? Yeah, I hope.
Yes, it is.
House Bill 185.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bob Heron, House District 38. House Bill 185 is a Title IV rewrite. Your vice chair and I have introduced this legislation. There is a companion piece on the other side as well. We look forward to working with this committee over the interim. Title IV, of course, is the statute that regulates alcoholic beverages, and the ABC board and staff and law enforcement carry out these laws. Why review Title IV? Well, it's been since 1980. There's been many an incremental updates, local option, and many other things. And so it was time for a review. And in spring of 2012, 60 stakeholders and staff, including myself and Representative Hughes, we dedicated time over these last 3 years to craft a set of recommendations to improve the structure, the organization, the policies, the and associated implementation of Title IV. Stakeholders included the alcohol industry, public health, local government, law enforcement, public safety, education, the court system, and community advocacy sectors. And there was two review goals. Was guided by these two goals, and that's promote a fair business climate and protect health and public safety, protect public health and safety, and make Title IV a clear and consistent legal framework used by licensees, the ABC board, and law enforcement. And there's a comprehensive package of interrelated proposals for revision. And, of course, it looks like a stout doorstop, but seriously, inside this proposal is the first time that all these stakeholders are taking a serious look at how Title IV can be improved. And again, Mr. Chairman, all the stakeholders who spent over 6,000 hours in dedicated time to craft this, we look forward to interim work, and then in January is to hopefully get through the legislature. Doesn't matter if it's the other vehicle, any other body, or this vehicle, but we want to work together.
Representative Jones?
I have one question, one quick comment.
You never do. You
want to. The first question is, Representative Heron, is this a simple bill?
Okay, it is definitely not a simple bill.
That doesn't even count as a question.
I knew that Representative Ledoux would like that. My comment really is that the main thing I'm going to be looking for is the consensus part of it, because, you know, many of us have heard that, and I don't know if this is said by one side or the other, there's more than two sides, just to sort of earn sympathy and have us look out for that part, that stakeholder's interest. But I'm going to want to know whether there's real buy-in during the interim if we hear more about this.
Mr. Chairman, and to Representative Josephson, the buy-in has already happened. Now, as you know, we will continue to work with all the stakeholders, but a legislative process does bring unusual and unforeseen circumstances and influences. And so, yes, the stakeholders are going to have, I would call, a tedious job of keeping the package together and then allowing for some suggestions that maybe nobody thought of. But it will be a balance.
Can I follow up just on that? I hear what you're saying, but that suggests to me that if the bill passed as written, everyone would be sort of equally content?
Well, maybe that word is a little generous. So I guess we'll see.
Okay, thanks.
Once it's, Mr. Chairman, but Representative Joseph, this has been essentially the stakeholders' product. Now we got to run it by the public.
I've had the pleasure of working with the representative for 4 years, 6 years on Labor and Commerce.
Yes, sir, 4 years.
And he is a consensus builder. He's one of the best in the building. So I wouldn't want that job or the Title IV rewrite. Representative Ledoux.
So I guess I'm just wondering, because this is a bill that has been put together with, I guess, the consensus of all of the stakeholders. Are we going to be hearing that we shouldn't amend this or we shouldn't amend that, because that's going to destroy the whole consensus, which kind of brings us back to House Bill 106 type problems?
Well, through the chair, Representative Ledoux, I think everyone recognizes that, and that's why I... people don't usually use the word tedious, but it's going to be all hands on deck on this, and I think that the stakeholders know that. Title IV is clumsy now. I'm just being polite, and so all the stakeholders are committed, and they recognize that a legislative process will bring undue and unforeseen influences.
Thank you.
Representative Hughes.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Heron. And I have been involved also, and it will be It will be a delicate balance, but, you know, I think the Stokes stakeholders do agree that it's that this is a process that needs to happen, but and I'm glad Representative Herron is at the helm, and I've had a little bit of experience of late with consensus building, too, because if we do see a place where we're going to need to make change, we will need to work together because there was a lot of compromise. Everybody did not get what they wanted in here, but they worked to balance it out. So change one thing, then we might need to be changing other things possibly. I mean, we just have to be aware of that. And when it's a smack at 100 pages long, there might be different places where there might be a lot of work to be done. So I also appreciate the chair bringing it forward at this time because I think having the interim to work on it will be good. So thank you. That was just a comment, not a question.
Any more questions for Representative Herron? Thanks again, and I think we'll be seeing you this summer if we're not down here still. Of course, if we are, we can probably hear it down here as long as we don't take any action.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for those kind words.
Thanks again.
Thank you.
Now we are down to a couple of Senate bills. Jane, looks like you're the only one in the room temporarily. Come on up. So this would be Senate Bill 71, Vaccine Certification for Pharmacists. Welcome back. Been a while.
Good afternoon, or maybe I should say good evening. I am Jane Conway, staff to Senator Giesel. I just sent her a little text. Senator Giesel is available. She's probably on her way down. But we can begin, if you would like, to talk about Senate Bill 71. Senate Bill 71 allows Alaska pharmacists to administer all vaccines without a collaborative practice agreement. Since 2001, Alaska pharmacists have required oversight by a medical doctor or a nurse practitioner to administer vaccines. These oversight practice agreements annually cost $50 to $500 for the pharmacist. It all depends on what kind of agreement they have with their oversight physician or nurse practitioner. And basically, the oversight really amounts to the physician or nurse practitioner just overseeing their immunization records. So right now, some pharmacies have difficulty in finding a collaborative medical doctor or nurse practitioner, and this hurdle does reduce access to needed vaccines for the public. And this is the impetus behind this legislation. SB 71 will give already educated and certified pharmacists authority to immunize Alaska adults and children without having to contract with often hard to find.
Excuse me for a minute. I'd like the record to reflect we've been joined by Representative Giesel, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Jane Conway, for the record, staff to Senator Giesel. I will continue, and maybe we can share this, but we were just on the fact that oftentimes it's hard for pharmacists to find an overseeing doctor or nurse practitioner. And I'm going to defer to my boss if she wants to continue or if you would like me to go carry on. Okay.
The appropriate is that the nurse sitting
yes,
here, right?
Yes, this is the nurse yeah. And senator sitting next to me. The appropriate clinical procedure for vaccine administration is part of the coursework for a pharmacy doctorate degree, and that has been the case since 2005. So the level of entry into the pharmacist profession is a doctorate or PhD of pharmacology. Pharmacists educated before 2005 are required to go through an immunization education program outlined by the Board of Pharmacy, and this is stated in the bill.
And actually, Mr. Chairman, Senator Kathy Giesel, Senate District N, just for clarification there, it's the vaccine administration program that the Board of Pharmacy would support. or would actually provide. The pharmacists already understand the vaccines themselves, the pharmacology of them, the side effects, etc. It's the administration that they would be polishing their skills on. Their education already includes the drug administration, or excuse me, the drug therapy, the dosing, the adverse events, and how to respond to adverse events. That was a big question in the other body, the other committees. How will they know what to do in an adverse event? Well, these are the folks that I call when I'm prescribing something because they know all the drugs. They know all the medications. So they're definitely qualified to do this. In addition, this piece of legislation will help rural communities where often citizens have more interaction with their pharmacist than they do their health care provider, because there's the pharmacist in the community, they're buying their shampoo there and whatnot, and there they go for their medications, and this would allow vaccine administration. In states where this has been approved, and many have already authorized this, they see higher immunization rates, something that Alaska could certainly benefit from. We do suffer from some rather low rates. Another question that came up is, well, how will this be written down for their primary care providers? Well, that we have a statewide database called VaxTrax, and the pharmacists would be required to enter the data into that database, which is accessible to all the healthcare providers in the state. In 2013, the pharmacists gave over 13,000 flu vaccines. So this legislation will definitely make more vaccines available through these pharmacists and pharmacies.
Representative Ledoux, followed by Representative Hughes.
Are pharmacists now required to enter data into the database?
Yes. Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, they are. Yes.
Thank you.
Representative Hughes.
Yes, I have a couple of questions, a short answer. And just to be clear, they're trained on the dosages and the adverse effects. Are they actually trained? Is it standard that they're trained and actually administering them, the hands-on with people? Is that standard part of their training?
They are educated in the administration from 2005 onward. So those pharmacists educated before 2005 would be required to take the vaccine administration course that the Board of Pharmacy would approve.
Okay, and a couple quick ones. The medical history of the patient, is that something that they would, as well as passing it on to the primary care physician before it's administered, is that something where there can that it's important for the pharmacist to do that? Because I'm don't think of pharmacists taking a medical history, but would that be part of the process in case the patient has some problem and it might indicate there'd be an adverse reaction?
Representative Hughes, through the chair, that's a great question. Right now, for flu vaccines, there's actually a document that the individual, the citizen, is given to fill out, citing what medications they're allergic to, chronic conditions, medications they're taking, etc. Same kind of scenario would exist for other vaccines as well.
Okay, and one final quick one, which I hope the answer is yes. I've always been a believer that providers should be practicing to the full extent of their training, and that will help costs come down. And because we're removing a layer of the collaborative agreement, do you see that this possibly, at least in some small way, might lower the cost of the administration of vaccinations and shots?
Representative Hughes, through the chair, I can't speak to that with assurance. Of course, that would be the goal. It certainly will reduce the cost for the individual professional who will be administering these, and also save some paperwork. It can take 6 months to a year to get these collaborative agreements solidified.
Yes, thank you.
Representative Ledoux.
Two questions. To begin with, I just want to make sure that I understand. When you talk about administering, we're not talking about paperwork. We're talking about actually giving the shots, right?
Representative Ledoux, through the chair, you are correct.
Thank you. And then the second thing is, well, it's kind of a comment and a question. I really, really like this bill. And I'm just wondering whether or not you could foresee it being extended, not in this bill, no Christmas trees or anything, being extended to allow pharmacists to have some limited powers to prescribe not just vaccines, but drugs. I mean, you know, antibiotic type of drugs. Just like when you're down in South America, and I think maybe in Europe, if you have a stomach ache and it's midnight, you don't go to the emergency room. You go to the 24-hour pharmacist. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, Representative Leduth, the Chair, I'm not real good at foreseeing things, so I try to avoid doing that. It would require a change in their educational programs, of course, to do diagnosis, which is a different skill set than the knowledge of the medications themselves. One way that scenario you presented, a stomach ache at midnight, we have nurse advice lines. In fact, the state insurance program has one where you can call and speak with a healthcare professional, get some advice, and then go to your 24-hour pharmacy and get something over the counter. We'll see how healthcare proceeds, though, in the subsequent years. Thank you for the question.
Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, certainly. Representative Josephson.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, Senator, would there need to be any change to the footprint of the pharmacy for administering the vaccine? How would that work?
Representative Josephson, through the chair, currently, remember, pharmacies and pharmacists are administering immunizations. In fact, I was picking up a prescription at Fred Meyer about a month ago, and the pharmacist was delayed. He was supposed to come and talk to me about the medication. He was delayed because he was in the administration room, the vaccine administration room, giving a vaccine. So they already have the facilities available there.
Representative Hedo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Giesel. So you've mentioned rural Alaska being a location where you'd have some problems maybe putting together one of these cooperative agreements with a doctor. Are there other circumstances that you can describe where doctors or pharmacists are having difficulty in putting together an agreement or a agreement with a doctor?
Representative Quito, through the chair, I can't speak to that with the same knowledge as probably the folks online who are actual pharmacists. They could tell you a bit more about that logistics issue.
Okay, thank you.
And if there are no further questions for senator or her assistant, I think we'll go to those people online. And first up, Barry Christensen, are you with us?
Yes, I am. Thank you, Representative. My name is Barry Christensen. I am co-chair for the Alaska Pharmacists Association. Our membership includes pharmacists, pharmacies, and pharmacy technicians in the state of Alaska. We are in full support of this bill. We think it's a win-win-win. It's a win for pharmacy because it ensures that pharmacists that are immunizing now are able to do that. It also, as mentioned, is going to open up things for pharmacists that have difficulty in obtaining a partner for a collaborative practice agreement. We think it's also a win for patients because it's going to open up some access and allow them to be immunized. Lastly, we think it's a win for employers potentially because we're going to keep people healthier. And the costs actually show that for every dollar you spend immunizing someone, you're going to save about $10 in overall health care costs. That's from the Center for Disease Control. This bill is got our support all the way from our mom and pops and stores in Alaska all the way to our chain stores. Some of those folks are online also. I think that they could address Representative Quito's last question regarding when there's also been problems with them with their collaborative practice type agreements. So that's all I have for now. I can answer any general questions.
Any questions? Thanks again. How about Liz Hutchin, National Association of Chain Drug Stores? Are you with us?
Chair Olson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Lise Houchin. I'm the Northwest Regional Director for the National Association of Chain Drug Stores. NACDS members in Alaska include Costco, Genoa Healthcare, Good Neighbor Pharmacy, HealthMart, Kars, Target, Walgreens, and Walmart. On behalf of them, I would like to thank you for hearing this important legislation to allow pharmacists to independently prescribe and administer immunizations in the state of Alaska. Senator Giesel made a reference to the fact that we're probably not doing as good a job in Alaska as we could. In 2012, only 1.2% of Alaskans were immunized for influenza flu, which ranked us 49th in the country. We're encouraged by Senate Bill 71 that many additional needed vaccines will be administered in local boroughs and villages by pharmacists to patients and families that may otherwise go unimmunized. So thank you for your time, and I'll be happy to take any questions.
Any questions? I'd like the record to reflect we've been joined by Representative Culver. We have almost a full committee. Thanks again. We have three or four pharmacists online for questions only, but I think are there any outstanding questions? I know the few that I've talked to have all been supportive, and I, by the way, have been going to my pharmacist for years for my flu shots and the rest of them, but and it's convenient and probably more reasonable for my insurance companies. With that, we have Jay Butler from Hess Online for questions. Anybody got any questions for Jay? Seeing none, we have Sarah Chambers in the room from Commerce. Any questions for Sarah? Well, with that, is there anybody online that would care to testify on the bill that we haven't got to everybody else's questions? Anybody in the room that would care to testify on the bill? Oh, how about Ryan Ruggins from Car Safeway?
Thank you, Senator. For the record, my name is Ryan Ruggles. I'm with Car Safeway in Alaska. I've got stores across the state. I am a pharmacist. I have been immunizing ever since I was an intern, all the way up until now. I am very much in support of the bill. I think it all boils down to access for the patients. We've mentioned previously somebody asked a question about some of the difficulty reaching the collaborative practice provider. For my stores, we have one that we use regularly and is normally available. However, in times where they might be traveling or are unavailable, in order to find a substitute, it can take quite some time, and oftentimes we end up just waiting for our other provider to get back to us in order to get the ball rolling again for our patients. I mean, it's simple things like that can cause delays, and I'm available for any questions I can definitely attempt to answer. And I want to say thank you very much for listening to speak today and for considering this bill.
Well, thanks for joining us. Is there anybody in the room that would care to testify on this bill? Seeing none, I think we will close out public testimony and bring it back to the committee for discussion. Representative Culver.
I think this is an excellent bill. This is exactly what we need to do to combat our rising health care costs. It's very common, I think, in other countries to have a streamlined process to administer vaccines. And like you said, Mr. Chair, I think a number of us are already getting our immunizations at our neighborhood pharmacy. So I think it's a good bill, and I appreciate the sponsor bringing it forward.
Representative Hughes.
Yes, I filled this out, but I'm holding it before I turn in because I have one more question, Mr. Chair. Just wondering, pharmacists are eager to get this in place, and I know your profession. Are the nurse practitioners supporting this, and the physicians? They also agree that this makes sense.
Representative Hughes, through the chair, we don't have specific letters of support from those other healthcare professionals, but there has been no opposition to the piece of legislation that we've received.
Okay, thank you.
I, too, will be filling a green slip out shortly, but are there any further questions of the sponsor? What are the wishes of the committee?
Move the bill.
Mr. Chair, I move SB 71 version 29-LS0591/W from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Seeing no opposition, the bill moves out of committee. We'll take a brief at ease. We're back on the record. Last item on the calendar today is Senate Bill 47. To present the bill is from Senator Coghill's office, is staff Herman Becerra. Welcome to the committee. I believe it's the first time you've been before us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Herman Becerra, legislative intern to Senator Coghill. Senate Bill 47, to summarize it as best as possible, is a very straightforward piece of legislation. This bill basically repeals and reenacts one section found in Title 39 of the Alaska Exemptions Act, specifically AS09.38.025, subsection A. And essentially, we are repealing and reenacting, repealing the $500,000 cap on the exemption of unmatured life insurance policies and reenacting as just a full exemption regardless of the value limit. The second section of the bill is just an applicability date, making the effective date applying the bill after the effective date of the legislation. This legislation came after consultation with members of the insurance industry and the trust industry in Alaska, who found that more private employees are now turning to life insurance and life insurance policies as new estate tools and retirement tools. And we found that granting a full exemption, not just a $500,000 exemption, was really a way to treat all retirement funds as secured, just as much as public employee retirement accounts or union member retirement accounts, which while they're held by the, which are completely shielded by the federal government and not subject to garnishment while they're held by them. We did also have a zero fiscal note attached to this legislation, and we do have, we did also want to state that this legislation does not shield life insurance policies from any type of criminal action whatsoever. This really refers to only civil litigation, and I believe you'll find in your bill packets the claims enforceable against exempt property section, I believe AS09.38.065, and here you'll find basically the list that is the exceptions to the exemptions of the Alaska Exemptions Act, things ranging from being able to levy against exempt property of any kind, to enforce claims for child support, local taxes, and finally, if I just may briefly read, Mr. Chairman, a creditor may make a levy against exempt property of any kind to enforce the claim of a victim, including a judgment of restitution on behalf of a victim of a crime or a delinquent act. We feel that is quite simply saying that this legislation will not stop someone from trying to seek just restitution in a criminal situation. We are aware that there is opposition to this legislation by the Alaska Bankers Association. We did receive a letter from them stating their concern that this is could possibly create some kind of attempted shielding assets that could be garnished by a bank. But we found that that explanation was found a little wanting. For one thing, under the Alaska Exemptions Act, under AS09.38.030, which is the exemption of earnings and liquid assets, it states quite clearly that a creditor can levy upon the earnings of an individual if the creditor's claim is enforceable under a court order of bankruptcy under the Bankruptcy Reform Act of 1978, and you can find this in under Title IX, and so we already believe that the concerns of the banking industry were very not quite accurate in their concerns about a debtor trying to hide or commit fraudulent action upon them. Finally, this legislation does not interfere with a debtor assigning a policy as collateral to a bank for a loan. You'll also find in your packet, I believe near the very end, AS 34.40.010, and this statute basically says that anyone who assigns any of their property, life insurance policy, for example, as collateral means that you are assigning that policy to them, and it is subject to garnishment should you, I believe the phrase is default. So we found with all of that in place that we really covered our bases in trying to make sure that there really is no fraudulent intent with this legislation that could come along, and we felt very comfortable that this would help make life insurance policies a more secure tool for estate planning while these policies remain unmatured. And with that, I'm willing to entertain any questions the committee may have, and I do believe we have a Matt Blockmacher online from the Alaska Trust Company to provide further information for the committee.
Well, I think after you, we'll be going to the director of the Division of Insurance, and then we'll get around to the public testimony. Representative Ledoux.
So let's say that somebody was driving drunk. Now, you say if it's a criminal action, that it doesn't count. But, you know, the standards of proof in a criminal action and a civil action are different. So that you might have a civil action against somebody for driving drunk. The police haven't been able, or the prosecutors haven't been able to convict this person under a criminal statute because they're the, you know, the reasonable doubt standard. But you are able to not prosecute him, but there's a civil action against this person. Maybe this driver, whether it be driving drunk, texting, another reckless action, has really, really, you know, devastated somebody. So what I'm hearing you say with this bill is that regardless of the amount of damages that this person has managed to incur through their reckless actions, that they get to keep this life insurance policy for, it could be worth $750,000, it could be worth $1 million, it could be worth $2 million. Am I understanding this correctly?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, the intent of the legislation isn't to harbor earnings or the investment or savings of an insurance policy or a cash surrender value. The intent of the legislation is to secure the investments a person makes in an insurance policy while the policy is unmatured. Once the policies have matured, once the assets have transferred over to the beneficiary, when the assets become the property of the beneficiary, those assets are attachable again. And what this legislation is trying to do is put AS 09.38.025, which is the section where this bill is changing, put it in line with the exemption of retirement plans, for example, which is found a little bit earlier in the Alaska Exemptions Act under AS 09.38.017.
Follow up. And so our retirement plans, are they totally exempt? I mean, there's no limit on retirement plans?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, yes, there is no numerical value limit that limits how much can be garnished from a retirement plan. They're fully exempted.
Well, I've got some problems with that, too. Thank you.
Representative Hughes?
Yeah, just to be clear, let's suppose someone owed $500,000 to their to the creditor, but what they have is unmatured. But let's say in 2 years it matures and they've got $2 million. At the point that it matures, can the creditor come after it at that point, or is it off limits altogether?
Through the chair, Representative Hughes, right now with AS 09.38.025 as it is without this legislation, when the policy has matured, those assets are attachable. This legislation pertains to exemptions of unmatured life insurance. Once that insurance has been matured, it is accessible to garnishment.
The follow-up?
Follow-up.
So do they have to wait the 2 years at the end and then come back, or is it attachable at the point where they're seeking to be paid, and then the person loses it that owns the policy?
Through the chair, Representative Hughes, I believe the once the value of the policy exceeds $500,000, then it can be subject to garnishment, not while it is up to or below.
Okay.
Follow?
And that's now. And then if this bill were to pass, they couldn't get it at all, right? Now or then, later.
Through the chair, Representative Hughes, if this bill were to pass, it would exempt all unmatured life insurance and annuity contracts, regardless of their value limit.
Representative Keto.
Thank you. Through the chair, I guess the question I have is what motivated the introduction of this legislation?
Through the chair, Representative Keto, there were a couple of things that motivated the introduction of this legislation. It first started with some conversations with folks from the trust industry in Alaska and a few from the life insurance industry who found that once they had clients who were buying policies and making it to that $500,000 limit, the market seems to keep coming back to them and asking for more protection. We found as we were doing more research, another reason we were motivated to introduce this legislation was looking at the protection that public employees have with respect to Social Security or things like the state's supplemental annuity plan. I believe in our research we found the top 10 highest gross retirement plans in the state's supplemental annuity plan were all over $1 million and all shielded from garnishment at this time, and we felt that this legislation was a way to try and equal the playing field for private employees trying to find a new estate planning tool to protect, to have that same feeling of security, much like public employees.
Certainly. So would this legislation have an impact on the expense of those policies?
Through the chair, Representative Keto, I'm not entirely sure if I understand your question.
So I guess if the policy has a certain value, there's going to be either earned interest or some other fee for maintenance of that policy. And I guess my question is, by creating additional security with the policy, are we actually decreasing the cost to the consumer for that policy?
Through the Chair, Representative Keto, I would defer that question to the trust industry expert we have available for testimony. I believe he could answer that question better than I can.
And we'll be getting to them after we talk to the Division of Insurance, but I see somebody else would like to testify. Ms. Moss.
For the record, Renee Moss, staff to Senator Calco. Through the chair, Representative Keto, one of the incentives we have with this, first of all, I think Herman did a very good job of stressing that in looking at this, we found that people who wanted to invest their own money into a retirement system were at a disadvantage because they are limited to $500,000 to get the same protection that public employees and union retirement benefits have. But also, we're trying to build a trust industry in Alaska that diversifies the economy and predictions are will contribute about $58 million in taxes to the state of Alaska next year. And one of the disadvantages to getting people to invest more than $500,000 into a life insurance or annuity program that can go towards retirement is that their money isn't secure anymore. It's unmatured, but it's still unsecure. So they're not going to place any more money into that life insurance policy. They're not going to be investing any more money in the state of Alaska. Right now in the trust industry, you have the Alaska Trust Company, who has $50 million in any given day deposited in North Rim Bank. And the only reason they don't have more in North Rim Bank is because they only deposit the money that is secured by FDIC. The rest of the money is invested in money markets and other investments. So we're trying to create an industry here and incentivize people to invest in larger life insurance policies because we get premium taxes for those life insurance policies.
Quick follow-up. I think I'd just like to make a comment, I guess, if we're talking about individuals investing more than $500,000, I'm thinking it's a very small pool of people in Alaska.
Through the chair, Representative Keto, we have people coming in from the outside investing in these life insurance policies, and I think when Mr. Blotmacher talks, he can tell you there are some substantial life insurance policies in Alaska going into hundreds of millions of dollars.
Representative Ledoux, followed by Representative Josephson.
I just wanted to try to figure out when you say that the money isn't secure. I mean, as long as you're paying your debts and you're not getting into any horrendous accidents or anything, I mean, it is secure as long as you're paying your bills, isn't it?
Through the chair, Representative. I guess I would say that they can go to other states to get the same life insurance policy. They don't have to come to Alaska because they get better guarantees in other states. But one of the objections we heard from the banks was that they couldn't get to a life insurance policy after they had loaned money prior to the insurance policy being issued. Banks are responsible for getting the collateral when they loan the money. We think it's a little bit disingenuous to say that they want to reach out after the fact and grab on to a life insurance policy that was purchased after a loan was approved with other collateral. If they have issued a loan and haven't the correct amount of collateral, that is a bank decision, and a person shouldn't be punished for it.
Representative Ledoux.
But I guess I'm not so much thinking about the banks. I'm thinking about John Q. Public, who wants to collect his debts.
And through the chair, Representative Ledoux, as Herman has said, Alaska state statute has exceptions to the exemptions, and it's a fairly lengthy list. So it's not a carte blanche protection or immunity from paying your debts by any stretch of imagination.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's in the same sort of realm as Representative Ledoux's. I mean, I took debtor-creditor in law school and have dabbled in bankruptcy law, most recently in a divorce case that I handled. And so much of what we do and own is constantly vulnerable. I mean, homestead exemptions... you have a choice between state and federal exemptions, but they don't give you a whole lot, which is intentional. It's designed to
to dissuade people from filing too swiftly for bankruptcy. I guess I just, if someone is this alarmist about their portfolio, we should all be, I guess, equally alarmist. But most of us sleep okay. We pay our bills and we take things one step at a time. We don't overextend our credit. We don't generally run into problems. I don't know if you have a response to that.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, I guess my response would be going back to the issue of equal treatment for retirement and the opportunity to build a nest egg for retirement. The public employees and union retirement benefits are protected under federal law, unlimited, and people who invest their own dollar in a retirement process have a $500,000 limit. So this definitely is a policy call, and as Representative Ledoux brought up, she has a problem with that, so it's maybe something that should be looked at all the way around. But our issue is that anybody who wants to have a retirement system should be treated equally.
Follow?
No.
Any further questions? We do have Lori Wang Heyer from the Division of Insurance here to answer all our questions. Some of them. Welcome back. Please state your name and affiliation for the record. Do you want Marty at the table as well? Or,
I got this.
You got solo?
I'm going to go solo. Thank you for having me this afternoon. My name is Lori Wang Heyer. I'm the Director of the Division of Insurance for the State of Alaska. I've had the opportunity to testify on this bill a couple of different times during when it was being heard on the Senate. And I guess to add to what the previous two speakers have said, the industry that we're speaking of here is kind of new to the state of Alaska. I think the insurance industry has gone to Senator Coghill, in particular the life insurance industry, and come up with an idea that is maybe perhaps something we have ignored. They have two bills this year, SB 15 and SB 47, and both are attempting to stimulate the insurance industry and perhaps provide something new to the state of Alaska. You know, you can look back at other jurisdictions and think, why is there so much business in Switzerland in the financial industry and insurance companies? Well, it's because they created a tax structure and they knew how to do it.
Excuse me for a minute. I'd like the record to reflect we've been joined by Senator Coghill.
And you can look at, you know, Vermont, and they're renowned for their captives. And why? Because they built a tax structure and they welcomed captives and they did it right. And you can look at the Bahamas and Bermuda and the Virgin Islands and the same thing. And these insurance, life insurance folks have come to Senator Coghill and said, we think we've got an idea for Alaska, and it's going to take a little bit of work on a couple of statutes, and this is one of them. And so the issue of the 500,000 limit is one. And it's not just citizens in Alaska, but some of the biggest policies we have, and we do track them in the state, have been sold to people that are not in Alaska. And part of the reason, which is, I think you may be hearing Senate Bill 15, is because we have a tax structure that is good. After 100,000, the tax rate drops from 0.1 to 0.08, or that's what the bill would do, but it's 0.1. It's very competitive right now. We're hoping to make it more competitive. That helps. If we could be more competitive, they think they will sell more. But again, we're faced with this $500,000 limit. That would, if we can get rid of the $500,000 limit, the insurance industry thinks we will be even more competitive. The second is that life insurance is a very safe or understandable retirement vehicle for a small employer. They don't understand stocks and bonds. They don't understand going into the market, but they understand a life insurance policy, and they feel comfortable getting one. But once again, when they get to a max of $500,000, then it becomes accessible to a creditor. And I understand the comments made by the committee of, shouldn't we all pay our debts? And the answer is absolutely yes. But there is the issue of fair playing. And those of us that are getting a state paycheck or paying into the union, ours is protected. Joe Blow on the street, who's running the mom-and-pop shop, his is accessible. As a creditor, you can get to his $500,000, his unmatured cash value. You can't get to mine, but you can get to his. and that's part of what the bill was. And there was a lot of research done on the Senate side to make sure that this was correct, and they were supportive of leveling the playing field. Now, this is not in Title 21, so I'll tell you this is not my forte, but I can tell you with the research we've done, there was also some comments made on the criminal. And yes, it is. This does not stand for criminal. It is a civil. Actions are, you cannot get to this on a civil, but you can get to it for criminal. And we did have a letter, I don't know if it's in your packet, but from the Department of Law to clarify that. And I understand where you were saying it can go from civil to criminal, and that is probably very true, but that it is not meant for civil protection or to give somebody an immunity from a criminal act, such as a DUI or something where someone may bring an action against you because of a criminal matter.
Representative LaDue.
I guess I've got a little concern that, I mean, you mentioned the Bahamas, you've mentioned Switzerland. I mean, I guess Switzerland lets you stick all of your money in an account, or at least at one point it did, that nobody even could know about, and then you could avoid taxes and, you know, you could avoid lawsuits and you could avoid just about anything. I'm just not sure that we want to necessarily set ourselves up and use those places, the Bahamas and Switzerland, as necessarily a model. I'm just not sure of that.
Through the chair, Representative LaDue, I understand your concerns, and I'm not saying we model ourselves after Switzerland. I'm just making the comment that there are other jurisdictions that have taken in the insurance industry or the financial industry and made a very good success and had a very well lifestyle for their constituents based on what they've been able to do. And if it's all totally right for us, no, but some of this does seem to make sense.
Thank you.
Representative Josephson.
Ms. Wimher, it sounds from your comments that the administration supports this bill. That's how I take your comments.
We've had no opposition to it, sir, through the chair.
I want to be clear about the words. You said you've had no opposition. You have no opposition? Well, or you've heard no opposition?
Through the chair, again, this is in Title 9.
Yes.
Through Title 21, what I have had no opposition from the administration has not given me any direction on this bill. But again, this is Title 9.
Okay. If I could follow up.
Certainly.
You know, it's a busy time, and so I have to vet this bill and spend real time with it in sort of a different venue than this one.
Actually, we're not moving it today.
Okay.
We have another meeting scheduled on, or it will be scheduled for Saturday, but I don't even know if it was the intent of the sponsors to get it through because it's going to judiciary next, if I'm not mistaken. But
I guess
that helps you.
Sure,
I have some questions, too. I just haven't started yet.
I just mean to say that normally, if the administration is neutral, it doesn't sound so sort of supportive. And that's how I've taken what you've said. And that's fine. I just wanted to clarify that.
Thanks. Yeah, and I appreciate your comments. And again, I've been called up in numerous times because the word life insurance is in the bill. And I've been called to testify on it, and I've said what I know, but again, it's a Title IX bill, and it's not Title 21, which is the insurance code.
Representative Hudo.
Thank you, and I think I just have a short comment based on some of the information that we've heard. I do think that we, in Alaska, do have to primarily look out for consumers and residents of Alaska. So making sure that not thinking about what's happening to draw investment in from outside, but if we're creating a product that is supposed to be sold in Alaska, that product actually does not harm anybody in Alaska. So I guess I am, I think I understand the goal. I do want to try and learn more about what those impacts or the potential impacts are to people that are here in Alaska.
Shelley. Representative Hughes.
Yes, and I know you have questions too, Mr. Chair, comments. What, this sounds like possibly a new economic opportunity for us. What do you foresee that kind of activity you think this could bring to our state? Is we're talking in the hundreds of millions of dollars. What might that mean for us?
Through the chair, the insurance industry, as we've talked about before, is the second largest contributor to the general fund in premium taxes. if the insurance industry is right in their predictions of what they can sell, it could be significant. We charge 2.7% as a rule on all premiums that come into the state. On life insurance, it drops down to 1% after 100,000 in premium. So there is a break after it gets to be a true large premium, not the value, but after a large premium. So there is a cut in the life insurance, but generally speaking, it's close to a 3% tax on premium dollars. So it is about $55, $56 million that's brought into the state in just premium tax. So if they were to be able to open up the market and entice people from the lower 48 in the trusts and the annuities and the life insurance that they're talking about, it could be significant.
Thank you. My turn.
Yes, sir.
We've been hearing the same thing off the same people. There have been at least two or three bills that I can recall that have involved them, one of which is the one that you just mentioned where we capped the tax or dropped it down to 0.8.
The proposal is to take it from 1% down to 0.08 in SB 15. Yes, sir.
And we were also told it was going to bring in a lot of money and they would get back to us and let us know how much it brought in and how much we gave up for it. I would like to see something in writing on that, on the bill we did a few years ago. And I think you know the one I'm talking about. But, I mean, we're hearing it's going to bring in all this new money, everything else, but we gave up a chunk of premium tax, and I have no idea how much we gave up on it. But I'm certain there are people listening right now that can probably help us out with that.
If you're talking 15, I don't believe 15 passed. It's coming up before you now that the premium.
No, this is the one from, I'm seeing heads shaking, yes. It's from several years ago, maybe three or four years ago.
All right. Then I will research that, and I will get that for you through the chair.
Oh, thanks. And any further questions for the director? Thanks again, Lori. We've got two other people online. Matt Brockmacher. Welcome back.
Representative Olson, thank you. And for the record, my name is Matthew Blotmacher. I'm affiliated with Alaska Trust Company. And the trust company, while we don't offer insurance services, and this wasn't necessarily a bill that we pushed forward, we are in support of it. The business that we are in, a substantial portion of that comes from, obviously, estate planning and estate planning with life insurance and annuity contracts. Happy to answer any questions. And Representative Olson, if I could, in regard to your question on how much we lost in revenue for the previous reduction in...
No, actually, it was lost in premium tax, as I recall.
In premium tax, the statute currently reads that we charge 2.7% on any premium under 100,000. After 100,000, it drops to 10 basis points. When that bill was originally passed, we went to the Division of Insurance and asked for the largest policy in premium-wise that was being paid in the state. We were told that there was no policy in excess of $50,000. So we doubled that and then made the break there. So really what this did was didn't give up any incentive or any premium tax revenue for the state, but gave us an incentive to receive additional large policies.
So it had no tax impact at all? Premium tax?
Representative Olson, it's my understanding that it did not.
I have to ask, why did we have the bill then? Why did we do the bill? If it, as I recall, it was going to bring in large premium policies, and if we haven't even had one policy that it impacted, if I'm understanding you right, what am I missing?
It didn't, excuse me, Representative Olson, it didn't, it did impact a number of policies that have come to the state because of that legislation, because of that statute. It just didn't cost the state anything to put that legislation into place.
Well, please continue.
So in general, the life insurance industry, is a growing industry in Alaska and does contribute a healthy amount to our tax base and to our economic activity. And as I said, the trust industry in Alaska deals with life insurance almost on a daily basis, and therefore we're in support of this legislation to continue in keeping Alaska as an attractive environment.
Any questions for Mr. Blattmacher? Representative Hughes.
Yes, thank you. If I understand you correctly, that last change, when it was lowered to the 1%, we didn't lose revenue. Can you tell us what we gained? You had people buying larger policies, and so that, do you know what that did as far as revenue to the state?
Representative Hughes, through the chair, I didn't intend to kind of hijack our discussion here regarding SB 47. The tax of life insurance is really in regard to SB 15, so if I've caused any issues, I apologize. To answer the question, we have received additional policies into the state that we likely otherwise would not have received because of our favorable tax structure. The exact number, dollar value of what we've received versus what we would have received is difficult to determine. I can say that it is substantial, the amount of large policies that we have now, and they do generate good revenue to the state of Alaska.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Thanks again. Linda Hubert, are you with us?
This is Linda. Can you hear me?
Yeah. Please identify yourself and read yourself onto the record. And thank you for joining us today. And I think we'll probably have a question or two as soon as we know who you are.
Very well. My name is Linda Hulbert. I live in Fairbanks. I have been involved in the insurance industry as an agent for the last 25 years. Prior to that, I spent 20 years in the educational community in Alaska. I don't represent any companies. I represent myself and the clients that I work with. I would like to make one statement prior to beginning, and I thank you for the opportunity. This protection is available in many other states throughout the United States. The states of New York, Florida, Texas, Arizona, and numerous other states have the exemption for life insurance and annuities as part of their state policies. If someone were to move from Alaska to New York and took their insurance policy with them and changed their residency, they would have this protection. So I would be glad to try to answer questions, but I think it's a fairness issue, as everybody has mentioned. I think it's an opportunity for us to create substantial additional state revenue and to provide an opportunity for savings. And with that, I'll answer questions. I don't mean to take up any more of your valuable time.
Oh, no problem. Any questions? Thanks again for joining us. Lori, could you come back up, please?
Sir, again, for the record, my name is Lori Wing-Heyer. I'm the director of the Division of Insurance.
NAIC, do they have any model legislation addressing this, or is this an item that's on your calendar on a regular basis, or?
No, sir. Not as respects the taking the cap off of the for the creditors. Again, because it's not Title 21. So it is not an NAIC model law.
Representative Kito.
Thank you. I guess if this is not your responsibility under the state, then whose responsibility is it?
To the chair, I don't know, Representative Kito. It's Title IX, and I'm not sure if it's Department of Law or quite who administers the title.
Thank you.
Can you find out by Saturday?
I can find out, sir.
Thanks again. With that, we'll be meeting on Saturday at a time to be announced, depending on what's going on. By the way, for people that haven't heard, the governor has requested that we come back in a joint session on Friday, so we'll see what happens on that. But again, with that, we'll adjourn at 6:15.